porch where I pay $20 for another month and send a message that will erase itself in 5 minutes. Nassau again. Important. 5 minutes pass with no response. I send the same message 4 times over the next 3 hours and hear nothing. After dark, I leave the office and walk a few blocks in sweltering heat. The days are long and humid, and the town is crowded with tourists. As usual, Luther Hodges is waiting on his porch, eager to get out of the house. "Hello, Padre," I call out.
"Hello, my son."
We embrace on the sidewalk, exchange lighthearted insults about gray hair and waistlines, and start walking. After a few minutes, I realize something is bothering him.
"Texas will kill another one tomorrow," he explains.
"Sorry to hear." Luther is a tireless abolitionist whose simple message has always been, since we can all agree that it's wrong to kill, why do we allow the state to kill? When an execution appears on the horizon, he and his fellow abolitionists write the usual letters, make calls, post comments online, and occasionally go to the prison to protest. He spends hours in prayer and grieves for murderers he's never met. We're not in the mood for a fancy meal, so we duck into a sandwich shop. He pays for mine, as always, and as soon as we're seated, he grins and says,
"Now, tell me the latest on Quincy's case."
Since Guardian began its work, we have opened 18 cases, 8 of which resulted in exonerations. 1 client was executed, 6 are current, 3 we closed when we became convinced our clients were indeed guilty. When we make a mistake, we cut our losses and move on. With 18 cases, we have learned that sooner or later, we'll get a lucky break. His name is Len Duckworth, and he lives at Sea Island, about an hour south of Savannah. He drove up, walked into our headquarters, saw no one at the reception desk, stuck his head into Vicky's room, and said hello. Vicky was polite, as always, but very busy. Within minutes, though, she was calling for me.
"This could be important," she says.
We eventually settle in the conference room upstairs with a fresh pot of coffee. Vicky and Maisie take notes, and I just listen. Duckworth is about 70, tanned and trim, the epitome of a comfortable retiree with plenty of time for golf and tennis. He and his wife moved to Sea Island a few years back and are trying to stay busy. He's from Ohio. She's from Chicago. Both prefer warm weather. He was an FBI agent in 1973 when Congress created the Drug Enforcement Agency, which sounded more exciting than his desk job. He switched agencies and spent his career with the DEA, including 12 years in charge of North Florida. For months now, we've been trying with no success to obtain DEA records from the 1980s. But like the FBI and the ATF, the DEA is tenacious about protecting its archives. One of Vicky's FOIA requests came back with a letter in which every word was redacted except for the A's and the's. This is indeed a lucky day. Duckworth says, "I know a lot about the drug business back then. Some things I can talk about, some I cannot." I say, "I'm curious about why you came here. We've been trying to get DEA files and notes for the past 7 months with no luck." "You won't get much because DEA always hides behind the excuse that its investigations are active and ongoing. It doesn't matter how old or inactive a case might be. The DEA's procedure is to give you nothing, and they'll go to court to protect their information. That's the way we operate it." "How much can you tell us?" I ask.
"Well, I can talk about the murder of Keith Russo because the case was closed over 20 years ago and because it wasn't a DEA matter. I knew Keith, knew him well because we flipped him. He was one of our informants, and that's what got him killed."
Vicky, Maisie, and I look at each other as this settles in.
the only person on the planet who can confirm that Keith Russo was an informant is sitting in one of our old mismatched chairs and calmly sipping coffee.
Who killed him? I asked tentatively.
Don't know, but it wasn't Quincy Miller. It was a hit from the cartel.
Which cartel?
He pauses and takes a sip of coffee. You ask me why I came here. I heard about your efforts to exonerate Miller, and I applaud what you're doing. They got the wrong guy because they wanted the wrong guy. I have a lot of background I can share without divulging confidential stuff. Primarily, though, I just wanted to get out of the house. My wife is shopping today around the corner, and we'll meet for a nice lunch later. I say, we're all ears, and we have all day. Okay. First, a bit of history. By the mid-1970s, when the DEA was created, cocaine was raging across the country and coming in by the ton in ships, planes, trucks, you name it. The demand was insatiable. Profits were enormous, and the growers and traffickers could barely keep up. They built huge organizations throughout Central and South America and stashed their money in Caribbean banks. Florida, with 800 miles of beaches and dozens of ports, became the preferred point of entry. Miami became the playground for the traffickers. South Florida was controlled by a Colombian cartel, one that is still in business. I was not involved down there. My section was from Orlando North, and by 1980, the Saltillo cartel out of Mexico ran most of the cocaine. Saltillo is still around, but it got merged with a bigger outfit. Most of its leaders got butchered in a drug war. These gangs are always up and down, and the casualties are breathtaking. The savagery is unbelievable. I won't bore you.
Please don't, Vicky says.
I have another quick visual of Tyler and the crocodile feast and say, we have a fair amount of background on Sheriff Fitzner and what went on in Ruiz County. He smiles and shakes his head, as if reminded of an old friend. And we never caught that guy. He was the only sheriff that we knew of in North Florida who was in bed with the cartel. We had him in our sights when Russo got hit. Things changed after that. Some of our crucial informants got lockjaw.
How did you flip Russo? I ask.
Keith was an interesting guy, very ambitious, tired of the small town. Wanted to make a lot of money. Damn good lawyer. He had some drug clients in the Tampa-St. Pete area and sort of made a name for himself. An informant told us that he was taking big fees in cash, reporting some or none, even moving money offshore. We watched his tax returns for a couple of years, and it was obvious he was spending a lot more than he was making on Main Street in Seabrook. So we met with him and threatened him with an indictment for evasion. He knew he was guilty and didn't want to lose everything. He was also guilty of laundering money for some of his clients, primarily the Saltillo boys. He did this by using offshore shell companies to buy Florida real estate and doing all the paperwork. Not terribly complicated stuff, but he knew what he was doing.
Did his wife know he was an informant?
Another smile, another sip. Duckworth could tell war stories for hours. This is where it gets really fun. Keith liked the ladies. He was careful not to chase them in Seabrook, but Tampa was another story. He and Diana kept an apartment there, ostensibly for reasons related to their work, but Keith used it for other reasons. Before we flipped him, we got warrants and had bugs in the apartment, office, even at home. We were listening to everything, including Keith's calls to his girls. Then we got a real shock. Seems as though Diana decided to play the same game. Her dude was one of her drug clients, a pretty boy who worked in Miami for the Saltillo cartel. Ramon Vasquez was his name. There were a couple of times when Keith was in Tampa hard at work, and Ramon sneaked into Seabrook to visit Diana. Anyway, you can imagine what kind of shape the marriage was in. So, to answer your question, we were never sure if Keith told his wife about being an informant. We warned him not to, of course.
What happened to Diana?
Vicky asks. Somehow the cartel found out about Keith working for us. I strongly suspect that another informant, a double agent, one of our guys, sold the information. It's a dirty business with loyalties that can change daily. Hard cash and the fear of being burned alive can flip a lot of people. They took out Keith, and Diana eventually left town.
And Ramon?
Asks Maisie. He and Diana hooked up in Tampa for a while, then kept moving south. We didn't know for sure back then, but we suspected he sort of semi-retired from his trafficking career and stayed out of trouble. Last I heard, they were still together somewhere in the Caribbean. With plenty of money, I say. Yes, with plenty of money.
Was she involved with the murder?
Maisie asks. That has never been proven. You know about the life insurance and the joint bank accounts, but that's not too unusual. I ask, why didn't you bust Fitzner and the cartel? Well, after the murder, the case evaporated. We were within a month or two of a huge bust that would have produced a lot of indictments, including some charges against Fitzner. We had been patient, too patient, really. But we were fighting with the U.S. Attorney's Office down there. They were overworked and so on. We couldn't get the lawyers fired up. You know how they are. After the murder, our informants vanished, and the case fell apart. The cartel got spooked and pulled back for a while. Fitzner eventually retired. I was moved to Mobile, where I finished my career.
Who would the cartel use to do the killing? Maisie asks.
Oh, they have plenty of gun thugs, and these guys are not always sophisticated assassins. They're brutes who'd rather cut off a man's head with an axe than put a bullet in it. A couple of shotgun blasts to the face is tame for these boys. Their murders are messy because they want them to be. If they leave behind clues, they don't care. You're never going to find them because they're back in Mexico or Panama, somewhere in the jungle. Maisie says,
but the Russo crime scene was clean, right? No clues left behind.
Yes, but Fitzner was in charge of the investigation.
I say, I'm not sure I understand why you couldn't nail Fitzner.
You say you knew he was guarding the port, storing the coke, protecting the dealers, and you had informants, including Keith. Why couldn't you bust him?
Duckworth takes a deep breath and locks his hands behind his head. He stares at the ceiling, keeps a smile on his face, replies.
That is probably the biggest disappointment of my career. We really wanted that guy. One of us, a law enforcement man, on the take and in bed with the nastiest people you could ever meet. Pumping cocaine into Atlanta, Birmingham, Memphis, Nashville, all over the Southeast. And we could have done it. We had infiltrated. We had built the case. We had the evidence. It was the U.S. attorney in Jacksonville. We just could not get him to move fast enough and take it to the grand jury. He insisted on running the show and didn't know what he was doing. Then Russo got hit. I still think about that guy, the U.S. attorney. He later ran for Congress, and I couldn't wait to vote against him. Last I heard, he was chasing ambulances with his smarmy face on billboards.
Maisie asked, and you say this cartel is still around?
Most of it is, or at least it was when I retired. I've been out of the loop for the past 5 years.
Maisie says, okay, let's talk about the people who ordered the hit on Russo. Where are they now?
Dunno. I'm sure some are dead. Some are in prison. Some have retired to their mansions around the world. And some are still trafficking.
Are they watching us?
Vicky asks. Duckworth leans forward and takes a sip. He thinks about this for a long moment because he appreciates our concern. Finally, he says,
I can only speculate, obviously. But yes, they are watching at some level. They do not want Quincy Miller exonerated, to say the least.
I have a question for you, he says, looking at me.
If your client walks, will the murder case be reopened?
Probably not. In about half of our cases, we manage to identify the real perpetrator. The other half, we do not. Here, it looks highly unlikely. The case is old, the evidence is gone, the real killer is, as you say, living well somewhere far away. Or he's dead, Duckworth says. Gun thugs don't last long in the cartels.
So why are they watching us? Vicky asks.
Why not? You're easy to watch. The court filings are public. Why not keep up with things? I ask, ever hear of a Miami drug lawyer named Nash Cooley?
I don't think so. Is he with a firm?
Varick and Valencia. Oh, sure. They've been around for years, well known in the trade.
Why do you ask?
Nash Cooley was in the courtroom last week when we argued our motion.
So you know him?
No, but we identified him. He was with a guy named Mickey Mercado, one of his clients. Being a good cop, he wants to ask how we identified the two, but he lets it go. He smiles and says,
yes, I'd be careful if I were you. It's safe to assume they're watching.
Chapter 29. According to Steve Rosenberg, Judge Marlowe has more clout than we gave her credit for. He suspects she lobbied the Alabama Court of Appeals to move at what could be a record pace. Barely 2 months after the hearing in Verona, the court unanimously affirms Judge Marlowe's command to DNA test the 7 pubic hairs, and they order the testing to be paid for by the office of the Honorable Chad Fallwright. Two detectives from the state police drive the evidence to the same lab in Durham that we used to test the saliva of Mark Carter. I stare at my phone for 3 days until it buzzes with a call from Her Honor herself. With perfect unaccented diction and in the most beautiful female voice I have ever heard, she says,
"Well, Mr. Post, it appears as though you are correct. Your client has been excluded by DNA testing. All 7 pubic hairs once belonged to Mr. Carter."
I'm in Vicky's office and my face says it all. I close my eyes for a moment as Vicky quietly hugs Maisie. Her Honor continues,
"Today is Tuesday. Can you be here for a hearing on Thursday?"
"Of course. And thank you, Judge Marlowe."
"Don't thank me, Mr. Post. Our judicial system owes an enormous debt of gratitude to you."
These are the moments we live for. Alabama came within 2 hours of killing an innocent man. Duke Russell would be cold in his grave if not for us and our work and our commitment to undoing wrongful convictions. But we'll celebrate later. I leave immediately and head west toward Alabama, phoning nonstop. Chad doesn't want to talk, and of course, he's far too busy at the moment. Since he'll try to screw things up again, and since he's incompetent to begin with, we're worried about the apprehension of Mark Carter. To our knowledge, Carter knows nothing about the DNA testing. Steve Rosenberg convinces the Attorney General to call Chad and get him in line. The AG also agrees to notify the state police and ask them to keep an eye on Carter. Late Wednesday morning, Duke Russell is lying on his bunk, the same one he's had for the past 10 years, reading a paperback and minding his own business, when a guard looks through the bars and says,
"Hey, Duke, time to go, man."
"Go where?"
"Going home. A judge wants to see you in Verona. Leaving in 20 minutes. Get packed."
The guard shoves a cheap duffel through the bars, and Duke begins stuffing in his assets. Socks, T-shirts, boxers, 2 pairs of sneakers, toiletries. He owns 8 paperbacks, and since he's read each at least 5 times, he decides to leave them for the next guy. Same for his small black-and-white TV and rotating fan. By the time he walks out of his cell, in handcuffs but no leg irons, his comrades are cheering and clapping. Near the front door, the other guards have gathered to slap him on the back and wish him well. Several walk him outside where a white prison van is waiting. As he leaves death row, he refuses to look back. At Holman's administration building, he is transferred to a county patrol car and whisked away. Once outside the prison, the car stops, and the deputy in the front passenger seat gets out. He opens a rear door, unlocks the handcuffs, and asks Duke if he would like something to eat. Duke thanks him, but declines. His emotions are overwhelming his appetite. 4 hours later, he arrives at the county jail, where I'm waiting with Steve Rosenberg and a lawyer from Atlanta. We've convinced the sheriff that Duke is about to be released because he is, in fact, innocent, so the sheriff is cooperating. He allows us to use his cramped office for our little meeting. I explain what I know to my client, which is not everything. Tomorrow, Judge Marlowe plans to vacate his conviction and order his release from custody. Idiot Chad is threatening to refile charges against not only Duke, but Mark Carter as well. His bizarre new theory is that the two of them tag-teamed the rape and murder of Emily Brune. The two of them have never met. As outrageous as this sounds, it is not surprising. When boxed in and bleeding, prosecutors often become wildly creative with new theories of guilt. The fact that Mark Carter's name was never mentioned at Duke's trial 10 years ago will kill this nonsense. Judge Marlowe is on the warpath and will not listen to it. And the Alabama Attorney General is putting pressure on Chad to back off. Nonetheless, he has the power to refile charges, and it is something to worry about. He could have Duke arrested not long after he's released. As I try to explain these legal vagaries to my client, he becomes too emotional to talk. We leave him with the sheriff, who takes him to the nicest cell for his last night in captivity. Steve and I drive to Birmingham and have drinks with Jim Bisco of the Birmingham News. He's rabid with the story and has circulated the gossip among his colleagues. Tomorrow, he promises us, will be a circus. We have a late dinner and find a cheap motel, one far away from Verona. We do not feel safe staying there. The victim's family is large and has many friends, and we've had anonymous phone threats. They, too, are part of the business. Before dawn, Mark Carter is arrested by the state police and taken to a jail in a county next door. The sheriff tells us this as we enter the courtroom and prepare for the hearing. As we wait and as a crowd gathers, I look out the window and notice brightly painted television vans in front of the courthouse. At 8:30, Chad Fallwright arrives with his little gang and says good morning. I ask him if he still plans to reindict my client. He smiles smugly and says no. He is thoroughly beaten. And at some point during the night, probably after a tense phone chat with the Attorney General, he decided to call it quits. Duke arrives with his uniformed escorts, and he's all smiles. He's wearing an oversized navy jacket, a white shirt, and a tie with a knot as big as a fist. He looks splendid and is already savoring the moment. His mother is on the front row behind us, along with at least a dozen relatives. Across the aisle is Jim Bisco and several reporters. Judge Marlowe is allowing still photography, and cameras are clicking. She assumes the bench promptly at 9 and says good morning.
Before we get started, I have been asked by Sheriff Pilley to inform the public and the press that a resident of this county, a man named Mark Carter, was arrested this morning at his home in Bayless and charged with the rape and murder of Emily Brune. He remains in custody and will appear in this courtroom in about an hour. Mr. Post, I believe you have a motion.
I rise with a smile and say, yes, Your Honor. On behalf of my client, Duke Russell, I ask that his conviction entered in this case be vacated and that he be released immediately.
And what is the basis of this motion?
DNA testing, Your Honor. We have obtained DNA testing on the 7 pubic hairs found at the crime scene. Mr. Russell is excluded.
All seven originated from Mr. Carter. And as I understand the facts, Mr. Carter was the last person seen with the victim while she was still alive. Is that so?
She asks this as she glares at Chad.
That is correct, Your Honor, I say with suppressed glee. And Mr. Carter was never considered a serious suspect by the police or the prosecutor.
Thank you. Mr. Fallwright, do you oppose this motion?
He rises quickly and almost whispers,
The state does not.
She reshuffles some papers and takes her time. Finally, she says,
Mr. Russell, would you please stand?
He gets to his feet and looks at her as if bewildered. She clears her throat and says,
Mr. Russell, your convictions for rape and capital murder are hereby vacated and dismissed forever, and they cannot be brought back. I was not involved in your trial, obviously, but I do consider it a privilege to be involved here today with your exoneration. A grave miscarriage of justice has occurred, and you have paid a dear price. You were wrongfully convicted by the state of Alabama and incarcerated for a decade, years that can never be replaced. On behalf of the state, I say that I'm sorry, and I realize my apology does not even begin to heal your wounds. However, it is my hope that one day soon you will remember the apology and take some small measure of comfort in it. I wish you a long, happy life with this nightmare behind you. Mr. Russell, you are free to go.
There are gasps and shrieks behind us as his family hears this. Duke leans forward and places both hands on the table. I stand and put an arm around him as he sobs. For some reason, I notice how frail and thin he is in someone's old sports coat. Chad hits a side door and makes his escape, too cowardly to walk over and offer an apology of his own. He'll probably spend the rest of his career lying about how Duke got off on one of those technicalities. Outside the courtroom, we face the cameras and answer questions. Duke says little. He just wants to go home and eat his uncle's barbecue ribs. I don't have much to say either. Most lawyers dream of these moments, but to me, they are bittersweet. On the one hand, there is immense satisfaction in saving an innocent man. But on the other, there is anger and frustration with a system that allows wrongful convictions. Almost all can be avoided. Why are we expected to celebrate after an innocent man is freed? I navigate through the crowd and walk with my client to a small room where Jim Bisco is waiting. I promised him an exclusive, and Duke and I unload. Bisco starts with questions about his near miss with the executioner 7 months earlier, and before long, we're laughing about Duke's last meal and his frantic efforts to finish his steak and cake before returning to his cell. The laughter feels good and comes easily, as do the tears. After half an hour, I leave them and return to the courtroom, where the crowd is loitering and waiting for the next bit of drama. Judge Marlowe assumes the bench, and everyone takes a seat. She nods, and a bailiff opens a side door. Mark Carter appears in handcuffs and the standard orange jumpsuit. He glances around, sees the crowd, finds his family on the front row, then looks away. He takes a seat at the defense table and stares down as his boots catch his attention. Judge Marlowe looks at him and asks, Are you Mark Carter? He nods. Please stand when I address you and answer in a clear voice. He reluctantly gets to his feet as if he's in control of the moment.
I am.
Do you have a lawyer?
Nope.
Can you afford one?
Depends on how much one might cost.
Very well. I'll appoint one for now, and he'll meet you over in the jail.
We'll come back next week and try again. In the meantime, you will be held without bail. Have a seat.
He sits and I ease forward to the defense table. I lean down and in a low voice say,
"Hey, Mark, I'm the guy who called you the night they almost killed Duke. Remember the call?"
He glares, and since he's cuffed and can't throw a punch, he looks as though he might spit.
"Anyway, I called you a cowardly scumbag because you were willing to let another man die for your crime, and I promised I'd see you in court."
"Who are you?"
he snarls. A bailiff is moving toward us, and I back away. In a brief ceremony, the staff at Guardian hangs a large framed color photo of Duke Russell on the wall with the other eight exonerees. It is a handsome portrait we paid for. Our client is posing outdoors at his mother's home, leaning on a white board fence with a fishing rod at his side, a big smile, the contented face of a man happy to be free and young enough to enjoy another life, a life we've given him. We pause and pat ourselves on the back, then return to our work. Chapter 30. Quincy thinks I'm here because I'm his lawyer, and part of my job is to see my clients at every opportunity. This is my fourth visit, and I bring him up to date. Of course, we have heard nothing from Judge Plank just down the road, and Quincy does not understand why we can't file a complaint and make the old fossil do something. I describe Zeke Huffey's performance in court and pass along the guy's apology for helping send Quincy to prison for the rest of his life. Quincy is unmoved. We kill 2 hours covering the same material. Leaving the prison, I head south on a county road that soon expands to 4, then 6 lanes as Orlando looms. Watching the rearview mirror has become a habit that I hate, but I can't make myself stop. I know there's no one back there. If they are listening and watching, they wouldn't do it with such an antiquated method. They might hack phones and computers and who knows what else, but they wouldn't waste their time chasing me in my little Ford SUV. I take a quick exit onto a busy thoroughfare, then another quick turn, and wheel into the vast parking lot of a suburban mall. I park between 2 cars, walk inside like an average shopper, and hike at least half a mile to a sprawling Nike store where at exactly 2:15 I find a rack of men's running shirts. Tyler Townsend waits on the other side of the rack. He's wearing a golf cap from a country club and a pair of fake tortoiseshell glasses. Glancing around, he says softly, "This better be good." I examine a shirt and say, "We have seen the enemy, and I think you should know about it." "I'm listening," he says without looking at me. I tell him about the hearing in front of Judge Plank, the appearance of Nash Cooley and Mickey Mercado, and their clumsy efforts to avoid being seen together. Tyler does not recognize either name. A kid with a big smile approaches and asks if we need help. I politely wave him off. I give Tyler all the background we have on both Mercado and Cooley. I summarize what Len Duckworth told us about the DEA and the cartel. "You suspected Russo was an informant, didn't you?" I ask. "Well, he was killed for a reason. Either his wife had him knocked off for the life insurance, which no one really ever believed, or he got in too thick with some of his shady clients. I've always figured it was the work of the drug gang. That's how they handle informants, like those 2 boys I described down in Belize, or wherever it was. Remember the photo post? Me on the zip line? I think about it all the time, and so do I. Look, Post, if they're watching you, then we ain't going to be pals no more. I don't want to see you again." He takes a step back, glaring at me. "Nothing, Post. You hear? No contact
whatsoever. I nod and say, "Got it." At the door, he scans the mall, as if he might see a couple of thugs with large guns, then walks away as nonchalantly as possible. He quickens his pace and is soon out of sight, and I realize how utterly terrified he is by the past. The question is, how terrified should we be of the present? The answer arrives within hours. We select our cases with great care, and once engaged, we investigate and litigate with diligence. Our goal is to find the truth and exonerate our clients, something we've now done 9 times in the past 12 years. However, it has never occurred to me that our efforts to save a client might get one killed. It was a prison beating with all the markings of an ambush, and as such, it will be difficult to get the facts. Witnesses are unreliable if they come forward at all. Guards often see nothing. The administration has every reason to cover up and to slant its version in a way most favorable to the prison. Not long after I said goodbye to Quincy that morning, he was jumped by 2 men in a walkway between a machine shop and a gymnasium. He was stabbed by a shank and beaten severely by blunt instruments and left for dead. A guard eventually walked by, saw him lying in a pool of blood, and called for help. He was loaded into an ambulance and taken to the nearest hospital, and from there was rushed to Mercy Hospital in Orlando. Tests revealed a fractured skull, swollen brain, broken jaw, splintered shoulder and collarbone, missing teeth, and so on, and 3 deep stab wounds. He was given 6 pints of blood and put on life support. When the prison finally called our office in Savannah, Vicky was informed that he was critical and not expected to survive. I was on the Jacksonville bypass when she called me with the news. I forgot all the other clutter in my brain and turned around. Quincy has no family to speak of. Right now, he needs his lawyer. I have spent half of my career hanging around prisons, and I've become accustomed to the violent culture, but not calloused by it, because caged men will always invent new ways to harm one another. But I've never considered the possibility of an innocence case being derailed from inside the prison by rubbing out the prospective exoneree. It's a brilliant move. If Quincy dies, we close the file and move on. This is not an established policy at Guardian because we've never been confronted with such a death. But with an endless supply of cases to choose from, we cannot justify our time in trying to exonerate anyone posthumously. I'm sure they know that, whoever they might be. For purposes of my own lengthy monologues behind the wheel, I suppose I could refer to them as the Saltillo Gang or something like that. But they works better. So they are watching our court filings. Perhaps they are trailing us occasionally, maybe hacking a bit and eavesdropping. And they certainly know about us and our recent victory in Alabama. They know we have a track record, that we can litigate, that we are tenacious. They also know that Quincy did not kill Keith Russo. And they don't like us digging for the truth. They do not want to openly confront us or frighten or intimidate, not now anyway, because that would verify their existence, and it would probably require them to commit another crime, something they would like to avoid. A fire or a bomb or a bullet could make for a mess and leave clues. The easiest way to stop the investigation is to simply take out Quincy. Order a hit from inside the prison, where they already have friends or know some tough guys who will work cheap for cash or favors. Killings there are so routine anyway. I rarely spend time reviewing the prison records of my clients. Since they are innocent, they tend to behave themselves, avoid gangs and drugs,
take whatever educational courses are available, work, read, and help other inmates. Quincy finished high school in Seabrook in 1978, but could not afford college. In prison, he has accumulated over 100 hours of credits. He has no serious disciplinary violations. He helps younger inmates avoid gangs. I can't imagine Quincy making enemies. He lifts weights, has learned karate, and in general can take care of himself. It would require more than one healthy young man to bring him down, and I'll bet he inflicted some damage of his own before he fell. Sitting in Orlando traffic, I call the prison for the fourth time and ask to speak to the warden. There is no way he'll take my call, but I want him to know I'll be there soon enough. I make a dozen calls. Vicky is hounding the hospital for information, of which there is little, and she relays this to me. I call Frankie and tell him to head south. I finally get Quincy's brother Marvis, who is working construction in Miami and can't get away. He is the only relative who cares about Quincy and has visited him regularly for the past 23 years. He is shaken and wants to know who would do this to Quincy. I have no answers. The collar usually works in hospitals, so I put it on in the parking deck. ICU is on the second floor, and I bluff my way past a busy nurse. Two huge young men, one white, the other black, are sitting on stools next to a room with glass walls. They are prison guards and wear the gaudy black and tan uniforms that I've seen around the Garvin Correctional Institute. They are bored and seriously out of place. I decide to be nice and introduce myself as Quincy's lawyer. Not surprisingly, they know virtually nothing. They were not at the scene, did not see the victim until he was in the ambulance, and were ordered to follow the ambulance and make sure the prisoner remains secure. Quincy Miller is certainly secure. He is strapped down to a bed that sits high in the center of the room, surrounded by tubes, monitors, drips, machines. A ventilator hums away as it pumps oxygen through a tracheotomy tube and keeps him alive. His face is covered with thick gauze with tubes poked through it. The white guard is telling me that he has flatlined three times in the past 2 hours. Folks came running from all directions. The black guard confirms this and adds that it's just a matter of time, at least in his opinion. Our small talk quickly runs out of gas. These boys don't know if they're supposed to sleep on the floor, find a motel room, or go back to the prison. The office is closed there, and they can't find their boss. I offer the shrewd observation that the prisoner is going nowhere. One of the doctors happens by and notices my collar. We step away for a quiet word. I try to quickly explain that the patient has no family, that he has been in prison for almost 23 years for someone else's crime, and that as his lawyer, I'm sort of in charge. He's in a hurry and doesn't need all this. He says the patient received multiple injuries, the most serious of which is severe trauma to the brain. Using pentobarbital, they put him in a medically induced coma to relieve pressure on the brain. If he survives, he faces a lot of surgery. The upper left jaw, collarbones, and left shoulder will be rebuilt. Maybe his nose. One knife wound pierced a lung. His right eye could be badly damaged. At this early moment, there is no way to predict the level of permanent brain impairment, though it will probably be substantial, if he makes it. I get the uneducated impression that the doctor is clicking through a mental checklist of Quincy's injuries, and since he'll die anyway, why name them all? I ask about his chances, and the doctor shrugs and says, 1 in 100, like a gambler in Vegas. After dark, my two buddies in uniform have had enough. They are tired of doing nothing, tired of getting in the way, tired of the frowns from the nurses, and tired of guarding a prisoner who couldn't possibly make a run for it. They're also hungry and judging by their bulging waistlines, their dinner hour is not to be trifled with. I convince them that I plan to spend the night in the visitor's lounge down the hall, and if anything happens to Quincy, I'll call their cell phones. I say goodbye with the promise that their prisoner is locked away for the night. There are no seats or chairs near the beds in ICU. Visitors are not welcome. It's okay to stop by for a look or a word if the loved one is able to talk, but the nurses are fairly aggressive about keeping the place as dark and quiet as possible. I make a nest in the lounge around the corner and try to read. Dinner is machine food, which is seriously underrated. I nap, unload a barrage of emails, read some more. At midnight, I tiptoe back to Quincy's room. His ECG is causing concern, and there is a team around his bed. Could this be the end? In some ways, I hope so. I don't want Quincy to die, but then I don't want him living like a vegetable either. I purge these thoughts and say a prayer for him and his medical team. I back into a corner and watch through the glass wall as heroic doctors and nurses work frantically to save the life of a man Florida tried its best to kill. An innocent man robbed of his freedom by a crooked system. I struggle with my emotions as I ask myself, is Guardian responsible for this? Would Quincy be here if we had declined to take his case? No, he would not. His dream of freedom, as well as our desire to help him, made him a target. I bury my face in my hands and weep. Chapter 31. There are two sofas in the ICU lounge, neither designed to be slept on by an adult. Across the room, one is being used by a mother whose teenage son was gruesomely injured in a motorcycle accident. I have prayed with her twice. The other sofa is where I wrestle with a hard pillow and nap fitfully until about 3 a.m., when I think of something that should have been obvious earlier. I sit up in the dimly lit room and say to myself, "Great dumbass, why have you just now thought of this?" Assuming the attack on Quincy was ordered from someone on the outside, then isn't he in more danger now than he was in prison? Anyone can walk into the hospital, take the elevator to the second floor, breeze past the ICU nurses at the front desk with a plausible story, and gain immediate access to Quincy's room. I calm down and admit my paranoia. There are no assassins on the way because they believe they have already taken care of Quincy, and rightfully so. Sleep is impossible. Around 5:30, a doctor and nurse enter the lounge and huddle with the mother. Her son died 20 minutes ago. Since I am the nearest minister, I get dragged into this drama. They leave me holding her hand and calling relatives. Quincy hangs on. The morning rounds start early, and I meet with another doctor. There is no change and little hope. I explain to him that I think my client could be in danger. He was attacked by some people who obviously want him dead. It wasn't a routine prison brawl, and the hospital needs to know this. I ask him to notify the staff and those in charge of security. He seems to understand, but makes no promises. At 7, I call Susan Ashley of the Central Florida Innocence Project and tell her about Quincy. We brainstorm for half an hour and agree that the FBI should be notified. She knows who to call. We also discussed the strategy of running to federal court and suing Florida and its Department of Corrections. We would seek an immediate injunction ordering the warden at Garvin to investigate the attack and open his files. I call Maisie, and we have a similar conversation. As usual, she's cautious but never shy about filing suit in federal court. An hour later, Maisie, Susan Ashley, and I have a conference call and decide to do nothing for a few hours. All strategies will change if Quincy dies. I'm in the hallway on the phone when a doctor sees me and approaches. I end the call and ask what's going on. He says gravely, "The EEG is showing a steady decrease in brain activity. His heart rate is down 20 beats a minute. We're getting down to the end and we need someone to talk to." About pulling the plug? That's not really a medical term, but it'll do. You say he has no family? He has a brother who's trying to get here. It's his decision, I guess. Mr. Miller is a ward of the state, correct? He's an inmate at a state prison, has been for over 20 years. Please, don't tell me the warden gets to make the decision. Absent a family member? Yes. Shit! If the prison gets to pull the plug, then no inmate is safe. Let's wait for the brother, okay? I'm hoping he'll be here by noon. Okay. You may want to think about last rites. I'm Episcopalian, not Catholic. We don't do last rites. Well, then do whatever you're supposed to do just before death. Thanks. As he walks away, I see the same two prison guards emerge from the elevator, and I greet them like old friends. They're back for another day with nothing to do but sit. Yesterday, I thought they were totally worthless, but now I'm glad to see them. We need more uniforms around here. I offer to buy them breakfast in the basement cafeteria and suspect they've never declined food. Over waffles and sausage, they manage to laugh about their problems. The warden called them in first thing this morning for an ass-chewing. He was angry because they left the prisoner without authority to do so. They are now on 30 days probation with demerits on file. They've heard no gossip about the attack, and as long as they're sitting around the hospital doing little, they will continue to hear nothing. However, the place where Quincy was jumped is known to be one of the few areas of the prison yard unmonitored by surveillance cameras. There have been other assaults there. The black guard, Mosby, says he knew of Quincy many years back before he was assigned to another unit. The white guard, Crabtree, never heard of him. But then, there are almost 2,000 inmates at Garvin. Though they know very little, they are enjoying the importance of being vaguely connected to such an exciting event. I confide in them that I believe the attack was ordered from the outside and that Quincy is now an even easier target. He must be protected. When we return to ICU, there are two uniformed hospital security guards milling about, frowning at everyone as if the president was back there on life support. There are now four young men with weapons on duty, and while none of them could sprint to first base without collapsing, their presence is comforting. I chat with a doctor who says nothing has changed, and I leave the hospital before anyone can ask me if Quincy's machines should be turned off. I find a cheap motel, shower, brush my teeth, do a partial change of clothing, then race away toward Garvin. Susan Ashley has been hounding the warden's secretary without success. My plans to barge into his office and demand answers are blocked at the check-in office, where I am denied entry to the prison. I hang around for an hour and threaten everyone who will listen, but it's futile. Prisons are secure for many reasons. Back at the hospital, I chat with a nurse I've been flirting with, and she says his vitals have improved slightly. His brother Marvis can't leave his job in Miami. No one from the prison will take or return calls. For lunch, I flip a coin, and Mosby wins. Crabtree orders a ham on rye and stays behind to protect Quincy. Mosby and I stroll down to the cafeteria and load our trays with leftover lasagna and vegetables straight from the can. There's a crowd, and we squeeze into the last table, one that presses against his stomach. He's only 30, grossly overweight, and I want to ask him how large he plans to be in 10 years, or 20.
Does he realize that at the rate he's expanding, he'll be diabetic by the age of 40? But as always, I keep these questions to myself. He is intrigued by our work and keeps looking at the collar. So I regale him with slightly embellished stories of the men we've walked out of prison. I talk about Quincy and make the case for his innocence. Mosby seems to believe me, though he really doesn't care. He's just a kid from the country working for $12 an hour because he needs the job. He hates it. Hates the fact that he works behind fencing and razor wire. Hates the danger of hurting criminals who constantly scheme of ways to escape. Hates the bureaucracy and endless rules. Hates the violence. Hates the warden. Hates the constant stress and pressure. All for $12 an hour. His wife cleans offices while her mother keeps their three kids. Vicky has found three newspaper stories about corrupt guards at Garvin. 2 years ago, 8 were fired for selling drugs, vodka, porn, and the favorite, cell phones. One inmate was caught with 4 phones and was retailing them to his customers. He confessed that his cousin stole them on the outside and bribed a guard to sneak them in. One of the sacked guards was quoted, "We can't live on $12 an hour, so we gotta do something." Over dessert, chocolate pie for him, coffee for me, I say, "Look, Mosby, I've been inside about 100 prisons, so I've learned a few things, and I know that someone saw Quincy get jumped, right?" He nods and says,
"More than likely."
For something really bad, a rape or knifing, you have to find the right guard who'll look the other way, right? He smiles and keeps nodding. I push on. "Last year there were 2 murders at Garvin. Either on your watch?"
"Nope."
"They catch the guys?"
"First one they did. Second guy got his throat cut while he was asleep. Still unsolved. Probably stay that way."
"Look, Mosby, it's important for me to find out who jumped Quincy. You and I know damn well that there's a guard or two involved. I'll bet one was looking out during the attack, right?"
"Probably."
He takes a bite of pie and looks away. After he swallows, he says,
"Everything's for sale in prison post. You know that."
"I want names, Mosby. The names of the men who beat Quincy. How much will it cost?" He leans in lower and tries to adjust his stomach.
"I don't have the names, I swear. So I'll have to get them, and I'll have to pay the guy. He might have to pay another guy. See what I mean? I'd like a few bucks, too."
"Sure. But can I please remind you that we're a nonprofit with no money?"
"You got $5,000?
I frown as if he's asked for $1,000,000. But 5 is the right figure. Some of the men in the gossip chain are prisoners who think in terms of the basics. Better food, drugs, a new color television, some condoms, softer toilet paper. Some are guards who need $1,000 for auto repairs." "Maybe," I say. "This needs to happen fast."
"What will you do with the names?"
he asks as he shovels in the last chunk of pie. "Why do you care? It's probably a couple of lifers who'll just get more time."
"Probably so,"
he says with his mouth full. "So we have a deal? You start digging, and I'll find some money."
"Deal."
"And let's keep it quiet, Mosby. I don't want Crabtree poking around. Besides, he'll probably want some of the fee, right?"
"Right. Not sure I trust him."
"I'm not sure I do either." We return to ICU and give Crabtree his sandwich. He's sitting with an Orlando City policeman, a big talker who tells us that he has been ordered to hang around for a few days. There are plenty of uniforms milling around, and I begin to feel better about Quincy's safety. Chapter 32. 28 hours have passed since the beating, and after 5 or 6 flatlining episodes, Quincy's monitors have begun to stabilize.
Though he certainly doesn't know it, there is slightly more activity in his brain, and his heart is a bit stronger. However, this does not inspire optimism among his doctors. I'm sick of the hospital and need to escape, but I can't get too far from the patient. I spend hours on my sofa in the lounge, on the phone, online, anything to kill time. Maisie and I decide to wait another day before contacting the FBI. The federal lawsuit can wait too, though we're having second thoughts about it. There is still no word from the warden, no contact with the prison. Mosby and Crabtree are instructed to leave at 5 p.m. They are replaced by a gray-haired veteran named Holloway, who isn't very friendly. He seems perturbed at being relegated to hallway monitoring and doesn't say much. Whatever, at least we have another armed guard on duty. I'm tired of talking to people anyway. Marvis Miller arrives early in the evening, and I walk him to the room to see his brother. He is immediately emotional, and I back away. He stands at the foot of the bed, afraid to touch anything, and stares at the mountain of gauze that is Quincy's face. A nurse needs some information from him, and I return to the lounge to kill more time. I have dinner with Marvis, my third meal of the day, in the cafeteria. He is 6 years younger than Quincy and has always idolized his big brother. They have two sisters, but don't speak to them. The family split after Quincy's conviction when the sisters assumed he was guilty. The jury said so, and they cut all ties. This upset Marvis, who has always believed his brother was framed and who felt strongly that he needed the family's support more than ever. After we choke down the food, we choose to sit and drink coffee rather than to re-enter the stultifying dreariness of the visitor's lounge. I explain my fears about Quincy's safety. I offer my rather speculative theory that the attack was ordered by someone connected to his conviction, someone who's afraid of our investigation. I offer a lame apology for what has happened, but he will have none of it. He is grateful for our efforts and says so repeatedly. He has always dreamed of his big brother walking victoriously out of prison, an innocent man. Marvis is a lot like Quincy, easygoing, likable, believable, a decent man trying to survive a tough life. There are flashes of bitterness at a system that robbed his brother, but there is also a lot of hope that a grievous wrong will someday be made right. Eventually, we drag ourselves upstairs, and I yield my sofa. I go to the motel, shower, and fall asleep. Mosby, meet Frankie Tatum. The rendezvous takes place in a honky-tonk on the outskirts of Deltona, far away from Mosby's world. He says he once frequented the place in his youth, but is sure no one will recognize him now. As always, Frankie scopes it out before they meet. It's almost midnight on a Thursday, and the place is deserted and quiet. It takes a couple of beers for them to relax with each other. Give Frankie two beers with a brother in friendly surroundings, and he can be trusted.
I need 6,000 cash, Mosby says.
They're at a table in the rear, near an empty pool table. The two guys at the bar cannot hear a word.
We can do that, Frankie says. What do we get for the money?
I have a piece of paper with three names. The first two are convicted killers pulling hard time. Parole is way down the road, if ever. They did the number on Quincy. The third name is the guard who was close by and didn't see a thing. Probably the lookout. There's no video. They picked a spot that is unmonitored. Don't know why Quincy was in the vicinity, because most inmates know better. A guy got raped there 2 months ago. Maybe Quincy figured he was too tough to mess with and just got careless. You'll have to ask him if you get the chance.
How much do you know about the two thugs?
Both are white, tough dudes in a tough gang. The Aryan Deacons. The first name is a guy I used to see every day when I worked his unit.